will now move to the second case on our docket this afternoon, Michael Anthony Almendarez versus the State of Texas. If our clerk will please announce counsel.
May it please the court, Ms. Jennifer Wren to argue for appellant and Ms. Lindy Borchardt to argue for the state.
Ms. Wren, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Ms. Borchardt. When I submitted this brief, I submitted it on four different issues. Unless the court has any reason or any questions for me on three of the issues, I'm going to just go based on my brief. And I was planning to argue mostly on the second issue, which is the issue involving the admission of evidence on the Confrontation Clause. And in talking with Ms. Borchardt, we kind of concluded that that might be the issue that y'all were most interested in hearing anyway, because it does seem to be the issue that is the least, I guess, the least settled under Texas law. My position for Mr. Almendarez is that the trial court erred by and abused its discretion by failing to admit certain evidence that the defense wished to admit into the case in front of the jury. There were, I'm sorry.
Solidify for us exactly yes. what that evidence is, because if it's what I concluded it was, I had trouble tying the fact that she dated an 18-year-old boy, what, she had been smoking or something, that didn't have anything to do with this incident.
I'll be happy to do that. I kind of split it up into two different sections in my brief. I called it kind of prior bad acts, which in hindsight might have been misleading because it makes it sound like it shouldn't come in under 608. But I split it into kind of prior bad acts and then prior false allegations, but they kind of all merge together. The reason that I believe that this evidence should have been admitted, there was evidence of the victim in this case sneaking out, spending time with her boyfriend, smoking. Yes. Sneaking out with boyfriends, smoking, drinking, taking the truck without permission. Yes. Yes. Those acts in and of itself aren't necessarily the acts that aren't actually what the trial counsel was trying to get in evidence. What he wanted to do, what he was trying to get in evidence was the motive for her making up this story that Mr. Almendarez sexually assaulted her.
All right, and how do you tie this?
Couldn't
tie those together.
Well, what Mr. Almendarez's testimony was outside the presence of the jury is that he knew she was doing all these things. He knew that she was drinking, smoking, all the things that we just talked about, and that he had told her he was planning to go tell her parents about this, and that in retaliation she said, if you tell them, I'll put you in jail. I'll get you put in jail. I will tell on you. I will make an allegation against you.
And was that allowed in?
No, that, well.
That's the important part, the threat. To get him in trouble.
The threat itself was allowed in response to the drinking, because the drinking was allowed in, because obviously the drinking was part of the offense.
The threat was allowed in, and that's what you're truly trying to show, that she had a motive to not tell the truth and to make this up. What difference?
What difference does it make? Well, I think what it does is it tends to corroborate the appellant's, Mr. Almendarez's story a little more, because she does say, yes, this happened, and yes, we had this conversation about this, and none of that was let in front of the jury, and so it kind of corroborates his story, which is, I was going to go tell on her about these things, and she threatened me, and said she was making up this, made a false allegation against me. Sorry, I kind of fumbled over that. When you put that with the other side of evidence that wasn't allowed in, which is prior false allegations that she had made against other people, I think it is very damaging. I think it was very harmful to the appellant, and it kind of underlined his defense. He wasn't able to make as strong a defense. Now, obviously, he was able to get some of that evidence in, the threat. That part was in. But without some of the background and some of the other details to help corroborate his story, I think it weakened it. It definitely weakened his defense.
So
does that make sense?
Is, if I understand it, mm-hmm. is you were able, or the testimony came in that he said this girl threatened that she was going to make some stuff up about me if mm-hmm. I told on her, and that she was going to get me in trouble. And so
yes.
what you're complaining about is you didn't, that the evidence didn't come in about what was getting her in trouble. To verify that he said, I was going to say that she was drinking, and when I said that, she threatened me and said, I'm going to make something up about you if you tell my parents that, and I'm going to get you in trouble. And so you didn't get to put on the stand. Now, it's true, you had been drinking, hadn't you?
Yeah. Well, the drinking actually did get to come in, but you know what, yes.
So
but yes, that is part of the complaint. The other part of the complaint is the false allegations that she had made in the past that were not allowed to come in.
But my recollection mm-hmm. was it was never proven they were false.
Well, there was evidence that there was evidence they were false. The CPS records showed them being ruled out, and I understand that doesn't equal necessarily false, but Ms. Burris actually testified that they were false, and there were, from the victim's testimony, there was some indications that some of it was false. I know she said yes and then said, no, it's not false, and she kind of changed her mind a little bit on it, but there was some indication that some of that was false in her testimony as well. And then you would have had Charlotte Burris's testimony, which is the stepmother to the victim, that yes, this was false. Along with CPS ruling it out, I think that would have, it would have helped defendant's case on showing that what Ms. Burris's motive was, or not Ms. Burris, the victim's motive was for making up a false allegation. I think without that part, the jury's left wondering, well, why would she do that? And I think that's the part that was kind of missing from his story. And I think it was a pretty integral part that was missing.
Robbed a 7-Eleven before, so he must have robbed this 7-Eleven. She made
no.
a false accusation before, so she must have made this one.
No, well, you know, you can't necessarily say that, but the cases in Hammer and Bilodeau do seem to say that you can in this situation. Both of those cases were involving a sexual abuse case, and the victim, the defendant wanted to bring in evidence in both cases that the victim had, or the victim had made up past assaults that were found to be false, and they had wanted to bring those into evidence. And the court in Hammer and Bilodeau both came back and said, yes, they should have been allowed to present that as a defense. So I understand where you're coming from on that, but the courts in Hammer and Bilodeau seem to say differently. They do say that seems to be allowed. Now, the court, the trial court in this case relied on Lopez to say that those past allegations were not admissible. I think that reliance on Lopez was misplaced. I think Lopez stands for the – in Lopez, Court of Criminal Appeals said 608, there's no per se exceptions to 608. We're not letting you just bring in any kind of bad acts. Just as an per se exception to 608, it's a case-by-case basis. In Lopez, the defense attorney – well, at least from the case, you don't see any argument about motive being the reason for needing to bring this in. In Hammer and Bilodeau, you do see the defense coming in and saying, this is showing the motive for the victim to make up a false allegation in our case. I think that's the difference between the two. I think that's kind of where the trial court, in this case, got off track on relying on Lopez, if that makes sense. In its brief, the state focuses more on 403 in saying why the evidence should have been excluded under 403, that it was more prejudicial than probative. I did not brief very much on that at all in my brief. And I would say that it is more probative than prejudicial. I think, like I said before, without this evidence that didn't come in, you're getting kind of a half story from the appellant. You're not getting the full story of his defense. You're not understanding the full reason why these girls would have forced him to write these supposed confessions and why he would have followed through with it. And you're kind of left with a half story as to why the victim would have made a false allegation in this case. As far as prejudicial, as we talked about, the threat was already in there and the drinking was already in there. So some of those things I don't think were highly prejudicial. I think it just kind of lends a little bit more credibility to the appellant's case when it's in. Everybody already knew, the jury already knew that she drank. So I don't think that some of those other things were quite as big of a deal. I don't think they're prejudicial, and it certainly wouldn't have consumed any more time on the case than was already taken, because all the evidence was put in over the 3 days. It just wasn't all in front of the jury. So that's essentially my argument on the second point of error. If you all have any questions. Oh, yes. Yes, I think you get to a harm analysis. I argued in my brief that the harm was under 44.2B, which is that it affects a substantial right. I think the harm is fairly obvious in the case, and it's probably for most of the reasons I already explained, that he wasn't able to present his defense. His side of the story wasn't corroborated as well. It lent more credibility to the appellant's story if some of this evidence did come in. And that's where I see the harm.
What about the other witnesses that she discussed the matter with, the victim? In other words, it wasn't just her testimony versus...
No, well, with the one witness that does kind of cut against us is Kelsey Knighton, because they didn't really have any kind of a credibility attack on her at trial. Shelby Crowley definitely was involved in the cover-up, and that would have been part of the story that would have come in with some of these acts with appellant's story. Yes, with Kelsey Knighton, there was no credibility question, but then there were things with her testimony that didn't mesh up with everything else that Shelby Crowley and the victim were stating either. So I think with taking everything in the whole... I'm sorry.
Kelsey's testimony didn't mesh up?
Kelsey, well, as far as Shelby, like Shelby had, in her testimony, had details such as that the victim was rocking her hips and enjoying things like that, that Kelsey says she didn't hear. So there were some differences just in details. If I'm remembering right, I believe it was maybe the oral contact that Kelsey didn't testify to, that Shelby did and the victim did, that Kelsey didn't repeat. So there were some differences there that I think the trial counsel could have worked with if he'd had some of this other evidence in to discredit Shelby Crowley and the victim a little bit more. I did notice that last week y'all issued a case in Green where you used 44.2A as the harm analysis, and I took it to be that you assumed it was a constitutional error and just found no harm under A. Obviously, I believe if you can find harm under 44.2B, you can find harm under 44.2A, so I don't think I need to argue that any more specifically unless you want me to. But otherwise, if you don't have any further questions, I'll give you back the remainder of my time and let you hear from Ms. Borchard. Thank you.
Mindy Borchard, Assistant District Attorney for Rice County. Ms. Wren, may it please the court. In response to point of error number two, the evidence before or at issue in response to point of error number two would be, as Justice McCoy pointed out, simple misbehaviors that unfortunately most teenagers do these days. Smoking cigarettes, she was 16 at the time, going out with an 18-year-old, taking the truck without permission, prior bad acts such as that. The other issue at hand would be her allegations to Child Protective Services of physical abuse. As to the prior bad acts of the victim, Judge Fostell did not abuse his discretion. He very carefully and methodically balanced under the 403 factors in determining that the evidence of the victim's prior bad acts should be excluded. Not all of the prior bad acts, but most of the prior bad acts should be excluded. Why, Justice McCoy, it's exactly what you just pointed out. He failed to find a nexus between these prior bad acts of the victim and any possibility of exposing a potential bias or motive to falsely testify. He could not find the proper nexus. There was not a causal connection, as the Irby case talks about, that is necessary when you're balancing whether otherwise inadmissible character evidence, which this is, becomes admissible because there's some connection, there's some nexus that the evidence would expose a bias or a motive to testify. Judge Fostell did not abuse his discretion in finding that the nexus simply did not exist in this case. Justice McCoy, it was the appellant's threat to tell their parents about her prior acts that created a possible motive for her to falsely accuse him of sexual assault. That is what the evidence is that would expose a motive. That evidence was presented to the jury. Although Judge Fostell limited the scope of cross-examination, the appellant in this case was able to fully present his case to the jury. In this case, the appellant testified. He testified that he denied sexually assaulting Shelby. He testified that the night in question, he provided Everclear alcohol to her and that they were both drinking. That Shelby became very intoxicated. She vomited on the rug. She spilled a drink by a computer. And that the next morning, the appellant confronted her. And he said, "Shelby, the drinking has to stop." And there was already evidence. Yes, yes, Justice McCoy. And there was evidence that he had been supplying her alcohol ever since he arrived at the house.
Okay, well, wait a minute. Kind of the over, I mean, from my viewpoint, the overarching concern here is that the defendant is able to put on their defense to this accusation. Clearly, one of his defenses was she made it up. And if his defense is she made it up, it seems like he ought to be able to put on all the evidence supporting his defense of she made it up. And part of that is, this isn't the first time she's made it up. I can put on evidence that she's made this up before, and it's turned out to be untrue, just like it's untrue now.
Well, there is no...
She should, under the rules of evidence, she should be able to do that, but theoretically, it seems to me that's all part and parcel of his defense. She made it up. I can prove it. She's done it before. She's done it again. And that's what he was trying to do.
Well, as far as she's done it before,
right.
You know, that went to she made false allegations of physical abuse against
right.
a stepmother.
Right.
As far as that, as far as the evidence at trial, the Lopez case is directly on point, in my opinion, because in the Lopez case, the facts are very similar. It was a sexual assault case where a little boy, where the appellant had wanted to introduce evidence that the small child had previously accused his mother of physical abuse, of throwing him against the washer and dryer. The appellant wanted that to come into evidence to show that he had made a false prior allegation. The court in Lopez stated, well, it was never shown that it was false, that there was a dispute over it. There were CPS records in the Lopez case, and it was closed. And the court correctly stated, we don't know why CPS closed the case. In this case, the CPS records showed that the stepmother, would over-discipline Shelby. So just because of the ruling doesn't reflect that it was a false allegation. Again, in Lopez, though, you go back to saying, is there a nexus between the two? And the court in Lopez was very clear in stating that a prior allegation of physical abuse does not have anything in common with an allegation of sexual abuse. Specifically in Lopez, the court said, the prior allegation that his mother pushed him against the washer and dryer has no connection to the fact that the appellant performed oral sex on the child, that there's nothing connecting the two. And in this case, again, going back to the facts in this case,
if what you said is true, just then, why would it make any difference that there was no allegation in the CPS record that it was made up, that it was false? If there's no nexus between the acts, why would they then discuss whether or not there was information in the CPS record that the allegation was untrue?
Well, I believe if you don't have a nexus, you can stop your analysis at that point in time. The court, for whatever reason, went on to address whether or not the allegations were false or were not false.
Say there's no nexus?
In the Lopez case, Your Honor?
In
the Lopez case, it states...
I should know instead of asking you, but I don't
know. Oh, no. Let me get to that, please.
When you first started talking about it, I thought the bottom line was going to be they couldn't prove the allegations were false. Couldn't prove them were false. They're not relevant.
Okay. I'm quoting from the case. In addition, the allegation that Paul's mother had physically abused him by throwing him against a washing machine has almost nothing in common with Paul's accusing Lopez of forcing Paul to perform oral sex on Lopez. And then it goes into as far as that it was false, or that the two accusations were similar. The evidence fails to have any probative value in impeaching Paul's credibility in that case. So, again, you go back to that 403 analysis that Judge Fostell properly, administered in the facts at hand. Again, in this case, the defendant was able to present his defense. He testified to such things as, Shelby, the victim, threatened to send me back to the penitentiary, that Crowley, her best friend, threatened to send me back, and in doing so, she coerced me into writing a very incriminating apology or confession letter, and she told me what I had to put in it. Additionally, he testified before the jury that he was aware of Shelby's past, and because of her past, he felt that she could carry through on getting him sent back to the pen. Additionally, he testified that there was something specific that happened in May of 2008 with Shelby and Crowley that even heightened his fear that they could send him back to the penitentiary. And so, interestingly, on cross-examination, appellant never asked the victim or Crowley, her best friend, about whether or not he had in fact threatened to tell the parents or that they had said they would send him back to the penitentiary. When given the opportunity, he did not take advantage of cross-examination. All he asked those teenagers about is whether or not you had input into what was written in the letter. The defendant in this case fully presented his defense before the jury. Judge Fostell did not abuse his discretion in merely limiting the scope of cross-examination. However, if the judge believes that the judge committed error by limiting scope of the cross-examination, this clearly is harmless error because of the overwhelming evidence of appellant's guilt. In this case, the appellant was 34 years old, had no credibility before the jury. He had been in the penitentiary for the majority of his life. He had only been paroled under 6 months when he moved in with his mother and stepsister Shelby, who was 16 at the time. Additionally, there is the note that he wrote. The note is in his own handwriting, and it's rather graphic. If you would permit me to read directly from the note, he starts out, and I'm paraphrasing it, but direct quotes, being drunk and feeling you respond back made me think it was okay to lick you down there. I stuck it in a little, and you said it hurt, and that was the only time I was inside of you. All of this in case you're stressing over being pregnant. You're not. He goes on, please forgive me. I wish you the best. I'm pouring out the alcohol today, and I will never drink in your house again. Highly incriminating apology letter in his own handwriting. His defense defied logic. Why? Because why would Shelby and Crowley mastermind this grand conspiracy, coercing him to write a very incriminating apology note, only for Shelby to tear it up in little pieces and throw it away? That was her testimony. When she read the letter, it made her so angry because it read as if she participated in this, as if somehow she wanted it. She became upset. She tore it up. She threw it away. Other evidence, appellant wrote two additional letters to her and a point. On cross-examination, he testified he did that on his own will, on his own accord. Again, incriminating in what they say, begging her forgiveness.
Do we apply a 44.2B harm analysis or a 44.2A harm analysis?
Justice Walker, I believe you would apply a 44.2B analysis because the defendant in this case presented his defense, whereas in the Green case, the defendant did not have the ability to present his defense, and thus it became a constitutional issue and a harm analysis under 44.2A. But I believe in this case, in the facts of this case, since the defense was able to present his full defense, that it would be analyzed under 44.2B analysis. So in closing, as I said, there was overwhelming evidence of defendant's guilt. In addition to all the letters that he personally wrote and was, are you okay, Justice Hoyt? That he personally wrote, there was also testimony, Justice Walker, that you pointed out. After Shelby had told her best friend Crowley about the sexual assault. Crowley confronted the defendant. Crowley, with a friend, Kelsey Knighton, went up. They were friends with the defendant. They confronted him, and he admitted to sexually assaulting her. Of course, he minimized it. Oh, we were both drinking. You know, things got out of hand. Yes, I had sex with Shelby. Well, they attacked Crowley's credibility, saying she was part of the main conspiracy. But they did nothing to attack Kelsey Knighton's credibility on why she would falsely testify as to admissions that the defendant made. Finally, and I think this is very telling, is when the appellant's mother, who's also the victim's stepmother, she confronted the defendant the night when the sheriff deputies arrived and it all came out as far as the sexual assault. She confronted her son and said, "What's this about you drinking alcohol with Shelby?" And he admitted that, yes, he had provided the alcohol, and they were drinking alcohol together on that night. The mother testified upon cross-examination and was impeached by a written statement she had earlier given. There was no testimony whatsoever that when the mother said, "Son, what's this about you and Shelby drinking alcohol? What's this?" Because they'd already known about the sexual assault. The deputies were there. The police cars were there. At no time did the defendant say, "Hey, Mom, this is a horrible misunderstanding. Boy, this is a setup. There's a master conspiracy out there. I was going to come tell you all about what Shelby had been doing, and she threatened to send me away." No testimony as to what his initial reaction was when he was confronted by his mother. Again, the evidence was overwhelming of the defendant's guilt in this case. I submit that Judge Fostell did not abuse his discretion in limiting the scope of cross-examination. However, the court believes that he did. It should be analyzed under 44.2B standard, and that any error was harmless because of the overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt. Unless there's more questions, I would ask the court to overrule appellant's points of error 1 through 4 and affirm the conviction and the sentence. Thank you.
Ms. Wren, rebuttal.
Yes. Just very briefly. The only thing that I would add, just to clarify, Ms. Borchardt talked about Lopez and how it was directly on point, and she uses the nexus the similarities between the evidence, like that the defendant was accused of a sexual crime and was trying to bring in past allegations involving a more of a physical abuse crime, which is more similar to this case than it is to both Hammer and Bilodeau. But the difference that I believe that the court needs to consider in this case is that we're talking about a different we're talking about the motive for bringing those allegations. And in Lopez, that's not something that the Court of Criminal Appeals actually considered. They were looking more at 608. They were looking at whether to carve out a per se exception to 608 with specific allegations like that. They weren't looking at that kind of issue like they were in Hammer and Bilodeau. And so I would just urge the court to consider that when they're looking at the facts in this case. And to reverse the conviction of appellant. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Your arguments and your briefing was excellent before us today. We appreciate it. Your case is submitted, and you will receive an opinion from us in due course. The court will stand adjourned.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.